is brought to you by Head Start Basketball.
The fans loved my style, and it was a high level, so I was fine. The daily culture, I wasn't concerned. I'm such an obsessive basketball person that those thoughts don't even enter my mind. I'm going over there to practice and play basketball. That's the only thing that concerns me. Nothing else does.
Kent Washington made history by becoming the first American to play professional basketball behind the Iron Curtain. In his memoir, Kentomania, he recounts his journey from grade school, when he was known as Peanut, to becoming the first Black American to play professionally in the top league in Poland. Kent began to tap into his talent as a basketball player in junior and senior high school in New Rochelle, New York. His obsessive work ethic started to pay dividends as he elevated his game and became a college player at Southampton College in Long Island. During a basketball tour of Communist Poland with his team in May 1976, Kent took the country by storm and became an overnight sensation. After finishing his education, he returned to Poland, under contract to play professionally. The Polish press dubbed his popularity Kentomania, and fans lined the sidewalks hoping to get into a game to see him play and to get his autograph. Kent's athletic and cultural journey is unique as he shares insights on his life behind the Iron Curtain. Our friends at Dr. Dish Basketball are bringing back their big buy one, get one offer to help fuel your team's off-season training efforts. From now until April 30th, buy one Dr. Dish All-Star Plus shooting machine. Get one All-Star Plus for $1,000. Take advantage of this offer while supplies last. Learn more at drdishbasketball.com and follow their incredible content at Dr. Dish B-Ball on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, and YouTube. Mention the Hoopheads podcast and save an extra $300 on the Dr. Dish Rebel, All-Star, and CT models. Those are some great deals, Hoopheads. Get your Dr. Dish shooting machine today.
Hi, this is Phil White, author of The Leader's Mind, and you're listening to the Hoopheads podcast.
Prepare like the pros with the all-new Fast Draw and Fast Scout. Fast Draw has been the number one play diagramming software for coaches for years. You'll quickly see why Fast Model Sports has the most compelling and intuitive basketball software out there. For a limited time, Fast Model is offering Hoopheads listeners 15% off Fast Draw and Fast Scout. Just use the code HHP15 at checkout to grab your discount, and you'll be on your way to more efficient game prep and improved communication with your team. Fast Model also has new coaching content every week on its blog, plus play and drill diagrams on its play bank. Check out the links in the show notes for more. Fast Model Sports is the best in basketball.
Get ready to take some notes as you listen to this episode with Kent Washington, author of the book Kentomania. Hello and welcome to the Hoopheads podcast. It's Mike Klinzing here with my co-host Jason Sunkel tonight. And we are pleased to be joined by Kent Washington, the author of the book Kentomania. Kent, welcome to the Hoopheads pod.
Thank you very much for the opportunity.
We are thrilled to be able to have you on, going to obviously dive into your book, what it's all about. We're going to let people know where they can go out and pick up a copy. But let's start by going back in time to when you were a kid. Tell me a little bit about some of your first experiences with the game of basketball.
Yeah, I've played all sports up to the age of 13. And then around 13, I began to get this unquenchable thirst to actually practice basketball. Playing games was not something that I really cared about. I loved to practice. And I began at 13, 14 to practice alone. I started to practice full court alone. I would find a park, a playground, a basketball court, and I would have to go full court or by myself. And what it did was it enhanced all parts of my game, conditioning, ball handling, get the shots up. And I just was obsessed with practicing basketball. I can't explain why. In my book, I just tell you how, why, and when. I try to articulate that it was just in my DNA that I became addicted, obsessed to practicing basketball.
Okay, so two questions come to mind. First one is, why full court? Why are you going full court as someone practicing by themselves? Not many people go full court. And then number two, what was the aversion to playing games? Was that you couldn't find games, or you just enjoyed practice more than going out and playing pickup basketball?
Great question. Full court was something that it gave me a game-like situation in my mind. So I could bring the ball up against man-to-man zones, and I was able to use my imagination to practice at game speed, break the press, break running jumps, set my team up, and then make shots. So I would go full court because it gave me game-like, imaginative games, situations. I could play pickup anywhere, and I did, but I always got my full court practicing before, because I had to get, because practice makes you better, not games. In games, you usually play to your strength. Practice, you can practice weaknesses.
So were you pulling out most of the stuff that you were doing just from your imagination? Because I often think, again, when you look back at the way basketball was when you were growing up or when I was growing up, so I'm 54 years old and I'm growing up well before the time that we have access to YouTube and all the drills and different things that players today can find, and coaches and all trainers, all this stuff that's out there today. So I was kind of like you in a sense of when I was going out and doing my workout, it was just things that I created that I felt would help me become a better player. So how did you kind of design what you were going to do each day? Did you have a set workout of, okay, when I get to the court today, this is what I'm going to do, and I do that for whatever, X number of minutes, or was it more improvisational?
It was improvisational. As I got into the 11th and 12th grade, I went to Walt Frazier's basketball camp the summer of my junior year, and I learned a lot of dexterity drills, and I would use those more often during the practices. So each summer I would learn things from certain camps and things, and form shooting too. And I would implore those into the practice as well. But most of it was improv. I was a very creative player when I played, and I used my practices to kind of develop, create, you know, that my ball handling skills, because I couldn't pass to myself. So
hard to work on passing when you're out there by yourself.
Exactly. So when I played the pickup games, that's when my instincts came into the passing, which I have an interesting imagination when I actually pass the ball. This is what kind of captured a lot of the coaches that saw me play. They were amazed the way I could pass.
Did you ever have anybody join you at all for your workouts, or were you always by yourself?
Yeah, it's great, because in the book, I tell a few stories. I played certain players one-on-one full court, because if anybody asked me to work out, I would say I only play one-on-one full court. And a couple of people that Dared came out. And as soon as they saw that I would actually press them full court, and when they missed or something, I would just drive it right back down and shoot jump shots. And after a couple of times up and down, they said, this is not quite what I want to do. But I had some friends that could really play, and we would play one-on-one full court games.
So I've got a one-on-one full court story for you. Mm-hmm. So when I was a kid, this is probably when I was, I bet I was 14, 15 years old, maybe 16. And there were some local courts by my house that were outdoor courts. And I used to drive up there. And of course, in the summertime, often I was up there in the middle of the day, the hottest part of the day. And one day I'm up there by myself and I wasn't working on full court drills. I was just working on my shooting or whatever. Mm-hmm. And a guy drives up and he was from a neighboring community and his name was Scott Roth and he had played at the University of Wisconsin. Mm-hmm. And he had an opportunity to play, he played a couple of years in the NBA, kind of drifted in and out of the league, mm-hmm. played in Europe for a time. And Scott pulls up into the parking lot of the courts and he gets out and I had kind of grown up watching him because he's probably 7, maybe 8 years older than me, mm-hmm. and pulls up to the court and he's like, hey, he goes, I'm looking for somebody to play one-on-one full court with me to help me get in shape. And I'm trying to work on certain things. And do you want to be that guy? And here's a player that I had watched when I was in elementary school and he was in high school and obviously great player, went on to play in the Big Ten, play in the NBA. And next thing I know, here I am playing one-on-one full court in July, 90 degrees mm-hmm. on these courts with a guy who is a professional player. And so I can attest to the value of playing one-on-one full court. I can also attest to the challenge of playing one-on-one full court in terms of your skill level, your conditioning, yeah. your, for lack of a better way of saying it, your will, right? Because yeah. if you don't get back on defense, there's nobody else getting back to cover you. If you feel like you're going to jog back one time, guess what? You're giving up a bucket. So it was very interesting to experience to play one-on-one full court. And again, just to have a guy of his caliber just kind of roll into the parking lot and ask a kid who was 7, 8 years younger than him, hey, you want to go one-on-one full court? Great for me. And then him and I became workout partners. We did a lot of stuff together from that point forward. Mm-hmm. But it's just kind of funny how that all came together for me.
Yeah.
So let me ask you this. As you are working on your game by yourself and you're seeing yourself obviously get better and then you're testing yourself and pick up games, as you get into high school, how does what you're doing by yourself and what you're doing in pickup games, how does that translate for you into, I'm going to just use the term organized basketball, when you get on your school team?
Yeah. So every summer I rededicated myself to getting better. And I would pick up new drills, new challenges. And my teammates knew me and they realized that I was unlike them, I was really driven. And I became a quiet leader without saying much because they realized how much time I put in. So when I started playing junior varsity and like varsity, I was already known as the court general, because everybody had that built-in respect because of how much work I always, you know, put in. And slowly but surely, accolades came just because I kept getting better. And it was a testament to myself that I realized that diligent work ethic and setting goals allow you to achieve. And you don't have to like talk about it. You just have to do it. So my discipline, the work I actually put in, paid off in organized ball, and I eventually, surprisingly, got a scholarship. And I didn't dream about playing, college or pro. I'm not a dreamer because dreaming takes no energy. You can dream without doing anything. I'm the kind of person that's going to set a goal and practice toward it and then set that next goal. And a college coach saw me at Walt Frazier's camp. And while people were eating lunch and taking like breaks, I was on the court, going up and down full court anytime I could, getting better. And he said, "I'm gonna keep an eye on this kid." So that worked out for me.
What's your favorite memory from playing high school basketball? And then we'll jump into your college experience.
Favorite memory? Well, anytime we played against Mount Vernon High School, which was loaded with pro players. My rival then was Ray Williams, who played for the Knicks. But I also played against Earl Tatum, the Lakers, Gus Williams. So there was a ton of people that came out of Mount Vernon High School. So anytime I played them, I knew that that was the measuring bar for how good is.
Yeah, it makes a lot of sense. And I mean, I think when you get a chance to test yourself, right, if you're a competitive player, you want to be able to go against the best players that you can find. A, it's a challenge, and B, that's how you ultimately improve your skills and how you get better. So you get an opportunity to get a scholarship. Talk a little bit about what that process was like in terms of making your decision about where you were going to go to school. Was it just strictly, hey, this is my one offer and this is the scholarship that I'm going to take? Or was the process more drawn out and difficult than that?
Yeah, it was very simple. So at the camp, Walt Frazier is a coach, Jim Kochlor from Southampton College on Long Island, which is now Stony Brook University out there. And he was interested in me. My senior year, I got, letters from junior colleges, D3 schools. I had little interest. St. John's wrote me, but I knew I couldn't play there. So the Southampton the college coach really pursued me. And I knew him from camp, and I knew that he wanted me there. So I put my trust in him, and he recruited me a four-year scholarship. And that was the year after the NCAA allowed freshmen to play varsity. So I could play varsity right away. A lot of people don't know the rules back then, but that was it. And back then also, I'm a little bit older. There was only about 150 D1 schools, which people, there's like 360 now. I mean, all the schools I played against in Southampton, most of these schools are like D1 now, So, and there were no conferences. Most teams were independent back there. So it was a totally different college field then. But I was committed to Southampton College because the coach showed, a lot of interest.
What was the adjustment like for you going from high school basketball to college basketball?
Yeah, that's a good question, and I write about it in the book because practices are so much more demanding because simply you're playing against 22-year-olds in practice, and so you have to engage yourself in a different way. It's just not like physical now. It's mental, emotional. You have to receive more information quickly because the college coaches don't have a lot of time to waste on explaining things. They kind of break you down from what your high school character is to now mold you into what they want there. So there's a lot of criticism that you have to kind of deal with without breaking down. And back then, coaches were screaming at you constantly. It's, you know, it's not a feel-good thing. They're on your case right. constantly. But I have thick skin, and I had a assistant coach there, Coach Lezak, that he was on me one day. I mean, just on me. And I got upset. I went, you know, I was downstairs getting dressed, and he came home and said, "Kenny, let me tell you something. I see something in you that you may not see." So it's when I stop getting on your case that you should be worried, because then I've given up. And once he said that, I realized his role was to drive me and push me to my max. And I accepted that. I understood it now.
Yeah, that's a great lesson. And it's one, I think, that when you start looking at the changes since you and I were playing college basketball to where we are today, and you're 100% right when you think about just the style of coaching back then, where most coaches were sort of that fire and brimstone, yeah. my way or the highway, yeah. and you didn't question or ask anything. You just kind of did what you were told if you wanted to stay yeah. where you were. And continue to be on the team. You just did what you were told. And obviously today things are a little bit more, a little bit different, where players can ask why and coaches share thoughts and ideas behind them. And it's much more collaborative yeah. than it certainly was when you and I were playing. And so I think that the lesson that you took away from that in terms of, hey, you just have to keep working. You have to persevere. You have to fight your way through that. I think that's a great lesson that you were able to take away. What were you thinking about in terms of a career at this point? What was your major? What did you go into college with the idea that you wanted to do when you got out? Or were you still just kind of focused on, hey, it's basketball right now?
That's funny, because when I left high school and I stepped on Southampton's campus, I realized time management, I was in control of. So I spent a lot of time practicing basketball, way more than during high school. Because now, no one was there asking me, did I do my homework? Did I eat dinner? Am I doing this? Am I doing that? I was in the gym way too much. My itch to practice basketball couldn't be scratched. I mean, I was out of control, and I knew it, but my obsession took over. And I over-practiced. I knew it. I couldn't help it. And the janitors and the guards, security guards, always they would tell me, just turn the lights off when you're done. Close the door and just make sure it's locked. And I was a sociology major, but basketball, and it wasn't because I wanted to play like pro or anything. I just wanted to play in college and be impactful. And in order to do that as a freshman, I had to be really, really good, because I was playing against juniors and you know, seniors. And in order to perform on a high level, I had to be better than everyone else. So that just took over.
I think it's easy when you start talking about college basketball and a desire to really excel. And let's face it, at any level, I don't care if it's high school, I don't care if it's college, I don't care if it's a professional level, the players who put the kind of time in like you obviously did are the ones that have a lot of success. And one of the things that this led to for you is an opportunity where your team traveled overseas and was able to play, and it got you some recognition and it got you some adulation. So tell that story about going overseas with your team and kind of what happened while you were there, and then we'll dive into what the ramifications were for you moving forward.
Okay. So my freshman year, I started, played well. Sophomore year, started, played a little bit better, got more mature, cut the turnovers down. And then I realized, you know, I'm not shooting the ball well, you know. So I rededicated my summer going into my junior year form shooting, a lot of form shooting. My junior year, I played really well. Average went up, assists stayed the same. I was always a good, like, floor general. And that summer, our college went on a trip to communist Poland. This was 1976 May. We were on a 20-day, 7-game tour. And in Poland, our first game, we got beat because the style of play, the rules and everything were so different. But they were really, really good. We were playing against men, pro men. But during the game, the rules they had there, the FIBA basketball rules, enhanced my game. And although we lost, I scored a tremendous amount of points, and my imaginative style of play, the fans went gaga for. And I didn't kind of realize why. I mean, this is just how I play, but they've never seen ball handling and passing the way I did. Fans come running out of the stands, I'm signing autographs and everything. The translator for us, we're doing like interviews with all of these like journalists. They want to know how I play like this and all that stuff. And during one of the tournaments there, the coach for a team asked me through the translator, would I want to come back and play? And I was like, you know, that's flattering, but I don't plan on playing basketball in Poland. You know, I had a couple of teammates that actually went to Sweden. So I said, oh, well, since they're there, maybe they'll speak highly of me, you know, who knows? And so that trip really, unbeknown to me, started something historical that I was going to someday engage in.
You know, sort of the how, the why behind your team at Southampton taking that trip. Like, why did you guys go to Poland? Obviously, communist country, probably not the most likely destination for a college team from Long Island to travel overseas to go play in that particular country. So do you know the origin of why the trip took place in the first place? I'm just curious.
Yes, I do. So the mayor and the city council of Southampton Township was Polish. They received an invitation if they had a college that wanted to go and tour. So it was just that. The mayor was Polish and the city council.
That is, I mean, when you start talking about little moments, right, that change sort of the course of your life. I mean, it's kind of incredible. It really, when you think about it, there's just so many small things that can make such a huge change. It's crazy.
Yeah.
What's your favorite moment from playing college basketball? Was it that opportunity to go over to Poland? Was there something else that stands out? Just like I asked you with high school basketball, what's your favorite memory when you look back upon your college career that sticks out for you?
I think there's no one thing. I think it's my growth from freshman to senior, coming in as a freshman, averaging 7.6 assists, and then finishing off averaging 23 points, being the most valuable player college division on Long Island, All-American small college honors, things like that. There was this steady growth, and that's what I'm most, I guess, proud of, because practice actually pays off. Now, my grades suffer.
So you eventually, though, were able to graduate.
Yes.
And then what do you do from there? How do you end up back in Poland? And then we'll dive into all of the interesting things that happened as you traveled back to Poland and just kind of what that experience was like for you. But let's start with graduation and kind of where you went from there, what your mindset was at that point.
Yeah. So I was chosen by, I graduated in 77. The Los Angeles, like, you know, there are like 15 round draft choices back then. Yep. It was ridiculous.
So yeah, back then there was a lot of rounds.
Yeah. So I was drafted after the 10th round. And when you're drafted that late, you go to the Los Angeles Summer League first. And they have about 80, there's so many players there. And you practice and they break you up into teams and you play games, and there's a lot of coaches there from all of the NBA teams, and they try to pick off some players. And long story short, I played well, but didn't make it. But I got to see how good is. And good is very good on the pro level. So I returned back home, and I have the Polish coach's address. So I got my degree. I was a few credits short, finished up, and I asked my dad, can I telegraph Poland and see if, you know, if there's any interest? And he knew that I'm going to do it anyway. So I did. We corresponded back and forth. And January 4th, 1979, I was on a flight over to play professional basketball in Communist Poland.
Hey, coaches. Today, let's talk about Integrity Insight, a mini course crafted for coaches focused on team conduct and values from our friends at Teams of Men. Why Integrity Insight? This course is a journey into your team's climate and culture. You'll reflect on past incidents, assess your team's communication, and plan for a future where integrity is at the core of decision-making, on and off the court. Integrity Insight comes with practical guides and digital tools for effective planning and collaboration. The goal? To empower you to lead a team where ethical conduct and character growth are paramount. This course is about transforming your team culture, embedding values and ethics in every aspect. Ready to dive deeper into team integrity? Email us at teamsofmen@gmail.com with the subject Integrity Deep Dive to get started. Were you at all? Now, I know you had obviously been there with your college team, and so you had had the experience of going into a foreign country, going into a communist country, an area where, again, at that time in the world, clearly the politics of that era and the Cold War and the rivalry between the Soviet Union and its allies, the United States and its allies. Were you at all? It's different when you're going
with a group and it's at least, I'm assuming, semi-organized when you're over there with your college team. Here now, it's just you going over there as one individual. Was there any hesitation, worry, or did you feel comfortable with it because of your experience previously?
I felt comfortable with it because I knew basketball-wise, I was okay. You know, the fans loved my style and it was a high level, so I was fine. The daily culture, I didn't know because we stayed in hotels there, so, but I wasn't concerned. I'm such an obsessive basketball person that those thoughts don't even enter my mind. I'm going over there to practice and play basketball. That's the only thing that concerns me. Nothing else does. Now, my mom was the absolutely bravest person for allowing me to go. You know, I wasn't brave at all. I knew what I was. She was like, you know, to let your 23-year-old son go to a communist country is like, you got to be kind of brave, you know, as a mom. But communism doesn't mean anything to me or my family because they haven't harassed my family in any way. I don't know anything about communism. I just knew when I was there, basketball was great. That's all I cared about. When I got there, I had to endure, you know, a lot of daily challenges.
How difficult was it to maintain your high level of practice? In other words, were you able to get into a gym whenever you wanted to be able to sort of deal with and satiate your obsession, for lack of a better way of saying it?
Absolutely. So we practiced twice a day, 10 to 12 and 4:30 to 6:30. And I would come an hour before we started the first practice, workout, practice, go home, eat lunch, rest. Then I would come back an hour before the second practice, work out first, and then practice with the team.
So you mentioned that you had some daily challenges, yeah, which clearly completely different culture, completely different style of government, completely different society. So just talk through some of those daily challenges and what you kind of had to face day in and day out to just to be able to live your life.
Yeah. You had to do a lot more with a lot less. Plumbing, electricity, refrigeration, things like that were substandard. But that's just how it is. A lot of public facilities don't have toilet paper. They have ripped up newspaper. Food, you have to be careful with what you eat because refrigeration is not great, so you don't know what is expired or not. transportation on the bus. My street wasn't paved. I lived a couple of miles outside of the center. Streets outside of that aren't paved, so when it like rains, it's like a muddy freaking like mess. It's just, you know, small challenges, things like that, that you run into daily that you have to get used to. It's part of your life now. Getting my clothes washed was something that I had to kind of figure out who could do it, but it got done. So things like that. There were the gymnasiums, the floors, a lot of them had a lot of like dead spots. So I would spend a lot of time on away game floors, our floor, dribbling around lengthwise, widthwise, to find where the dead spots are so I could stay away from them. The locker rooms were interesting, to say the very least. you know, it's just things like that you have to kind of deal with on a daily basis. But, you know, I was there to practice and play basketball, and that's what kept me focused. And it's because of my basketball upbringing that I was such a disciplined player that liked to practice alone, because by practicing that way, it put me in my place of like solitude. So loneliness was to me solitude. And if I wasn't raised that way athletically, I could never have survived those challenges in communist Poland.
How was the language barrier with you, your teammates, your coaching staff? How were you able to communicate? Was it strictly the language of basketball? Did some of the people associated with the team speak English? Did you pick up any Polish while you were there? Just how did you communicate with your teammates and coaches that you were interacting with every day?
Yeah, they hired a translator my first year. He was there both practices and a couple of away games. So he would help me through certain plays and like timeouts if we wanted to run something special. Practice, he didn't have to translate that much because drills are drills and it's a universal language. The players I played with are instinctive, highly skilled, serious ballers. You know, basketballs, but as soon as they got used to my passing and they started to look for it, because I used to hit guys in the head with the ball the first practice. And until we, you know, the coach stopped practice and he explained, listen, guys, you know Kenny, you've seen him play during college. So keep your hands ready and keep your eyes on him. And it worked out fine. You know, it took a practice or two, but they taught me more about basketball than I taught them, because the game there is body move, ball moves. Here it's point guard dribbles all the time when I used to play in college. You know, I had the ball too much, but there the ball's gone out of my hands. So I learned how to play a different way. Their big men are so skilled in on a screen. They don't always roll. They pop because they can shoot. Our big men have to roll because they don't trust them shooting. Over there, they pick and pop. So I was seeing our you know, like centers, like 7 feet, pop out, catch, and they would shoot. So it was a different game, but I loved it. It was much faster, much more physical than what I was actually used to. Because of the rules, too, they allowed you to play fast. The referee hardly ever touches the ball back then. The foul lane's a trapezoid, so there's not a lot of deep low post stuff. The low post is quite a bit further out. So it was an interesting game. That was the first time I ever came in contact with the dribble handoff. I never saw it before in American basketball. That was the first time there. So that was different. The way, you know, and, you know, the Eurostep here now, which was actually traveling back when I played, they were doing that all the time there. So I was trying to take a charge. They were just like stepping around me, laying the ball in, you know.
You're like, what is this? Yeah. I say that all the time. There's so many things that I see in the game today that I'm like, Yeah, I wouldn't have been able to get away with that. That would have definitely been called. I tell people all the time, Kent, one of my moves that I loved to do when I was playing pickup basketball was just go for a regular layup, but instead of picking the ball up normally and kind of have it at my waist, I would dribble the ball and then kind of pick the ball up and then kind of loop it above my head to bring it to my left hand and then go up and shoot. So you kind of lift it above the defender if somebody was reaching in from the side and pull that ball up above them. And I used to get called for traveling all the time on that when I try to do that in a regular game. And I'd stop and I'd try to explain to the ref. I'm like, look, just watch my feet. It has nothing to do with what my hand is doing with the ball. I'm just shooting a regular layup. It's just the way I'm picking up the ball is different. And I think it was such a simple move and a simple adjustment that I was making. And yet I couldn't convince referees that it wasn't a travel. And now I look at all the footwork stuff and what guys do. I mean, it really is kind of incredible just how the game has evolved and changed in that way. It really is amazing. And so it's interesting to me that you were already seeing that type of footwork going on in Poland back in the 70s. That's kind of amazing when you really think about it.
Yeah. I mean, that was everything. They had to modify the NBA rules as you know, the Europeans come, because they wouldn't be able to play here. Everything would be a travel or, you know, something like that. So as they engaged them, and I saw back then, I played against the Russian national team in West Germany, and Vidas Sabonis was 18 or 19. And
but you saw him at his peak.
Yeah. Their whole team could have played in the NBA then, but they weren't allowed to. I mean, picture Russian national team then. There are six different Russian countries that it's been broken up into. They were one national team back then.
You know, that's crazy. That's crazy. The talent level.
Yeah, yeah. The Yugoslavs too. That was one national team. They're like four different national teams that are still good. Serbia is good. Croatia is good. All of them. They were one national team then. The Russians were too. They were tremendous. I played against Detlef Schrempf when he was 18 out of West Germany. I played against Drazen Petrovic. He was like 17 out of Sabanka. I mean, I saw this influx coming back then because they were so good, but they couldn't get out of their countries.
All those guys, when you think through the history of basketball, and they're sort of the first wave of players who eventually, now by the time Sabonis got here, he was a shell of what he was athletically because of all his injuries and his age and whatever. But when he was 18 or 19, like when you saw him, everything that I've ever read, seen, heard people talk about was just that not only was he phenomenally skilled, which we still saw when he got to the NBA at age 33 or 34 when he got to Portland, but that he was also just an incredible, unbelievable athlete before injuries robbed him of all that. And then you think about some of the other names you mentioned, and just those are guys that are pioneers in bringing that European style of basketball here to the United States. For you to be able to see that, witness it firsthand, and as you said, kind of almost get a sneak preview of what was coming as we moved into the future is really, really cool. What was your experience like as an African American? Obviously, as you walk around the streets, you become fairly recognizable, if for no other reason than the color of your skin. So what do you remember about just your experience in that way, just being an African American in communist Poland?
Yeah, well, of course, you know, I'm a novelty at first because I'm black and everybody, you know, there's a lot of curiosity, of course, you know, about that. And then as I start to like settle in, everybody knows who I am, Ken Washington. So the novelty of me being blackface, and now I'm just a basketball player, you know, who's, well, kind of famous there. I hate that word. But to my neighborhood or to outside areas where my translator and me would maybe go for lunch and travel like an hour outside of town to the country or something. And most people there never seen a black person. So, you know, they're staring and stuff like that. But, you know, it's curiosity. It doesn't bother me. But of course, they want to ask questions, and my translator's got to, you know, we got to stop and answer a lot of questions and things like that.
Right, which right.
Yeah, you know, it's cool. But I never, you know, there was one game we were in Warsaw playing against Legia, and they're a soccer club, but they have notorious soccer fans that go to the basketball games, and they so Roots was being shown in Poland, and I didn't really know this. And I'm warming up, and all of a sudden they're chanting "Kuta Kente, Kuta Kente, Kuta Kente," you know. So I start to smile, and I'm like, "Are they saying what I think they're saying?" You know. So I think to myself, you know, I'm gonna show them some basketball they've never seen before. They've never seen what I'm gonna show them. And I went to work on this team. After the game, they come flying out the stands, hugging me and kissing me and wanting my autograph and all that stuff. So, you know, I faced little, if any, kind of racism at all. You get the occasional drunk that says something, but as soon as they find out I'm Ken Washington, the basketball player, they apologize, they come over, they're going to kiss you on your cheek, and they're going to hug you, you know. So I drew a lot of attention in both ways, yes.
Would you say that as a society at that time, I think the perception probably would be that it's a very strict, button-down environment. What did you find in terms of just your freedom to kind of move about and do what you needed to do what you wanted to do? Were you able to kind of just live your life? Obviously, again, there's a language barrier and you're focused on basketball and all those kinds of things, but just what was the society like in general, just in terms of the living conditions for the citizens and your freedoms to be able to move around and live life?
Yeah, interesting question. Very intriguing. So from their standard of love, like, they're, you know, it's a poor country. There's no question about it. People have a good time because they smoke, drink, and they party at the restaurants when there's like a live band. So that's pretty much what they do. Life is pretty humdrum there. Everybody works because the state provides you with a job, whether you like the job or not. So it's pretty, it can be seen as pretty depressing. My life there, with my translator, the first year and a half, I had a translator for that long. I went around, I went to practice by public transportation. I walked in town as I got to be able to do things on my own, which I did. I would go to restaurants and eat, and I would do things with no problem. Now, I was back in Poland this September for the first time in 40 years. I met my translator there. I asked him, "Do you think I was spied on while I was there?" He said, "You absolutely were spied on. There's not a question about it. No American comes into Poland without them knowing and being spied on." He said he was himself asked to keep tabs on me, but refused. So I went about my business. I did what I thought I wanted to do when I wanted to, but apparently I was always being watched.
You didn't sense that. You didn't feel that in the moment.
They were very good at it because I didn't sense it at all.
Hey, coaches, we know you're invested in the next generation of athletes. So why not give them the star treatment this season with Game Changer? Introducing Game Changer, a free app that provides you with data to make strategic coaching decisions and to deliver memorable moments to your team and its fans. Engage your players, empower your coaching decisions, and give parents the thrill of watching every play unfold in real time this season. Download Game Changer now on iOS or Android. Game Changer equips your team with the tools they need to succeed. Download it today and make this season one for the books. Game Changer. Stream. Score. Connect. Learn more at gc.com/hoopheads. That's gc.com/hoopheads.
When did the idea for the book pop into your head? Was that something that you had been mulling over, thinking about for a long time, and it just took you a while to sort of pull the trigger and get started on it? Or was it something that one day you were kind of sitting back and reflecting upon your experiences and thought, hey, I think there's a book here? Just give me the genesis of where the idea for the book came from.
Yeah. In 2019, I was contacted by a Polish journalist on the 40th anniversary of me actually being there. She, after we spoke, she said, do you realize how you impacted Polish society? And I said, no, I just played basketball. She says, no, it was much more. She said, you are a legendary figure to us. I'm like, what? What are you talking about? You know, I mean, that's just playing basketball. She said, no. She said, you should seriously think about writing a diary, a memo, or something down, because the Polish people would love to hear about you. So after the interview, I took out my articles. I got like photos. I started to research, and I found out that I was the first American to ever play pro behind the Iron Curtain. I contacted a Russian sports authority. He said he knew of me there, and he guaranteed that I was the not only the first pro basketball player, but probably the first American to play any sport there. So I said, really? He said, oh, yeah, yeah. There's not even a question. So I started to write the book of my time in Poland. And when I finished that part, I said, you know, I didn't just go to Poland in a vacuum. Something came before. So then I wrote about my basketball journey from sixth grade on. And I wanted the Polish people to understand how I felt about them and their country at that time. I owed them that. And I wanted Americans to hear my story and realize that communism is not an indictment on the people that live there. They're people. And that's how it got done.
What was your process for actually sitting down and writing the book? Were you sort of the 30 minutes a day guy? Would you write for long stretches? Just how'd you go about, what was your process for getting the book written?
Yeah, so first I invited a friend over who spoke fluent Polish, and she went through the articles. And as she was going through them, she started to cry. And I was, are these tears of joy or pain? And she says, joy. You have no idea how they wrote about you here, even in sports, and just about you, how they adored you there. I mean, these articles are unbelievable. So she helped me through that. And then I chronologically went back through each year I was there and told different stories, situations. I was in both daily, like cultural, and just basketball too. So I would just write randomly is not the right word, in a chronological order as I could, because when I started to think back and see articles, and I got a lot of like pictures, I knew exactly what happened at that time. Like, it is embedded in my mind. So I just started writing and rereading and rewriting and editing and rereading, writing. I gave it to an editor, and she said, you know, you need more dialogue to make it come to life. So I did that, and then she read it and said, this is a great book. And I was like, yeah, well, you're saying that because you're my editor. She went, let me tell you, the story is unique beyond, like, I wouldn't believe it. She said, it sounds like a Hollywood script that somebody came up with. And then they said, nobody's going to believe it. Let's throw it away. Because who would believe that you would go to Communist Poland to play basketball? It doesn't sound real. So after I read it, she said, it's so simply written and so understandable. It's really good. So I was saying, well, I guess we'll see how good when we actually publish it, you know.
What was that process like, the publishing, once you have the book done and you're getting it out and trying to market it and get it in front of people? How did you think about that, or who did you have helping you, and how'd you go about trying to promote it and get it out in front of people?
Yeah, well, while I was writing it, I was constantly in contact with Polish professors at various, like, six different universities who knew about me playing basketball there. And I would write, and after I wrote it, I let them read it to see if it was authentic to them. It had to pass the Polish test. And they said, brought tears to their eyes, how I depicted Communist Poland at a time where they were trying to get out. I was coming in and actually finding a joyous life there. So I had Cold War experts. I've done podcasts. They can't believe that I was there. Can't believe that I could go back and forth. Can't believe that I was never contacted by the embassy during martial law. They are just so academically, everybody likes it. So now I had to figure out how to get it to the average person. So I'm not a big technology guy. You know, friends read it, colleagues read it, and it's kind of word of mouth. I think I sold about 700 books here, and in Poland, it's in Polish now. I sold about 500 there, but it's just the tip of the iceberg there. It's going to start to just really blow up there. I just got it out there. So my marketing, you know, no publishing company would do it because I guess it's such a simply written book. I've been told it's not professionally written. You could have maybe used a ghostwriter. I said, I didn't want anybody else. These are my words. This is my voice. I can't have somebody else writing it, it wouldn't be my voice. So it'll I'm waiting for a national, you know, everybody tells, this is going to make a great documentary. Get in touch with ESPN. Like, I'm going to call up ESPN and say, yeah, I'm Ken Washington. I got no name recognition here, you know, none. You know, oh, call up Stephen A. Smith. He'd love this. And how am I going to get in touch with these people? But there are film production companies in Canada and in Holland that are researching my story and are interested in making a documentary. ESPN contacted me. I contacted them. They wrote back, but I haven't heard anything yet. So I'm not sure if it's more of an international story than a national story, because here we only talk about integrating sports. I didn't do that. I'm not sure what I did, but I didn't do that. You know, so it's not a story where I, you know, Jackie Robinson, Sweetwater, Cutcliffe. It's not that type of story. There was an essay written by a person that read my book, and he compared my story to Jackie Robinson. And his last comment was, Kent Washington went through much more than Jackie Robinson did.
Well, here's what I will say, Kent. I know that it's a very, very interesting story. It's a very unique story. I'm not sure that you or I or anyone else can define it or put it into a category. But when you consider all the different pieces that go into it, you have a communist country, you have a lone African-American basketball player, you have the time in the world where the story is set. And it's just, again, your experiences there were extremely, extremely unique. There are very few, and in fact, no one else who had a similar experience to the one that you had. So to be able to share that story, first of all, in your book, and then secondly, if your story does eventually get told in the form of a documentary, that would be amazing. And it would be a story that I think that anybody who watched it would be compelled by it because, like I said, it's so unique. So before we wrap up, I want to give you a chance to share, let our audience know where they can find the book, how they can get it, how they can support you. And then after you do that, I will jump back in and wrap things up.
Okay. The book is called Kentomania, A Black Basketball Virtuoso in Communist Poland. It's on Amazon Books, $14.99. And before you purchase it, you can go on and read ratings, reviews, and see what's said about it. And I think it's a compelling read for basketball parents, basketball players, historians, because parents always say, oh, my kid loves basketball. And I say, yeah, you know what they love? They love watching it and playing it. Do they love practicing on their own? Not with a coach, not with a shooting coach, not with a paid person. Do they enjoy practicing it on their own to the point where you have to say, Jimmy, Joni, come inside, stop practicing basketball? See, that's the love. Parents see it as, oh, they're always watching it. They like to play games. You like it very much then. There's a difference.
There certainly is. There is no question about it. So I would urge everyone in our audience, everyone who's listening, please go out, support Kent, pick up a copy of Kentomania. It will be well worth your time. Excellent book, excellent story. Kent, cannot thank you enough for taking the time out of your schedule to jump on, share your story, let our listeners know about your book. We thank you for that. And to everyone out there, thanks for listening. And we will catch you on our next episode. Thanks.
Your first impression is everything when applying for a new coaching job. A professional coaching portfolio is the tool that highlights your coaching achievements and philosophies, and most of all, helps separate you and your abilities from the other applicants. The Coaching Portfolio Guide is an instructional membership-based website that helps you develop a personalized portfolio. Each section of the Portfolio Guide provides detailed instructions on how to organize your portfolio in a professional manner. The guide also provides sample documents for each section of your portfolio that you can copy, modify, and add to your personal portfolio. As a Hoopheads Pod listener, you can get your Coaching Portfolio Guide for just $25. Visit coachingportfolioguide.com/hoopheads to learn more.
Thanks for listening to the Hoopheads Podcast, presented by Head Start Basketball.